we all know that drilling, whether in the Arctic or in the Gulf of Mexico, is not a risk-free activity.
The federal government considers drilling plans in the Arctic Ocean. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, September 13th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a blueprint for safer shipping in the Aleutians.
These are large expenses, but this area is a national treasure and is something that needs to be protected.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
Each year, thousands of ships travel through the Aleutians on the Great Circle Route, and that number only continues to increase. It's one of the faster ways to get cargo from Asia to America, but it can also be a perilous voyage. The Aleutian Island Risk Assessment is an effort to keep maritime disasters from happening in the region, and its advisory panel has just released a set of recommendations that they say could improve vessel safety in the immediate future. KUCB's Alexandra Gutierrez has more details.
In 2004, the cargo vessel Selandang Ayu ran aground on Unalaska Island. And ever since, local officials, conservationists, and mariners have called for more resources to handle the marine traffic in the Aleutian region. But before they could even hope to get funding for things like ocean-going tugs capable of rescuing distressed vessels, they realized they had to demonstrate need. That's where the Aleutian Islands Risk Assessment comes in. The project was created in 2007 by state and federal agencies, and it was tasked with figuring out how much damage a wrecked oil tanker could actually cause. Now, the Risk Assessment team has completed the first phase of their project, and they've released a report with concrete ideas for preventing and responding to maritime disasters in the region. Shirley Marquardt is the mayor of Unalaska, and she served on the advisory panel. She says that the important thing was coming up with a strategy that can be implemented soon and with relative ease. That means bringing more emergency towing systems to the region, increasing the towing capabilities of Coast Guard cutters, and developing a vessel tracking system.
Those are kind of the low-hanging fruit that we feel that we could move forward with fairly quickly.
Whit Sheard is a senior advisor for Oceana, and he also served on the panel. He says the kind of traffic moving through the Aleutian region can pose a particular threat to the area's commercial fisheries and wildlife because these cargo vessels have bunker fuel on board. That type of fuel is incredibly dense and harder to clean up than crude oil. Sheard says that the report makes the case that increasing investment in the region to prevent spills would ultimately cost less than responding to them.
This is something that we should do immediately, and we must find funding for, whether it comes from the shipping industry itself, from the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund, or from congressional authorizations. You know, these are large expenses, but this area is a national treasure and is something that needs to be protected.
With this report issued, the Aleutian Island Risk Assessment Team will now begin Phase B of their project, which will focus on long-term solutions to handling marine traffic. In Unalaska, I'm Alexander Gutierrez.
After the Deepwater Horizon spill last year, the Minerals Management Service became the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, Regulation, and Enforcement. Now the federal agency that oversees offshore drilling in the U.S. is undergoing another transition. On October 1st, it will become two separate bureaus, one to oversee resource development and one to focus on safety and enforcement. MOMRA Director Michael Bromwich was in Alaska recently to talk about the agency he has been overseeing for the past year. I sat down with him and the Alaska Office Director, Dr. James Kendall. I asked first about the agency's recent conditional approval of Shell's plan to drill up to 4 wells in the Beaufort Sea next summer. If the company gets final approval, it will be the first offshore drilling project in the Arctic Ocean since the Gulf disaster. But Bromwich says it's far from a done deal.
I want to emphasize that no approval has been given to drill any wells yet. That's contingent on Shell, in fact, dealing with all the conditions we've imposed, and those largely relate to various aspects of how they would deal with a potential spill or blowout. And so chief among them is their need to demonstrate that they have the containment resources available to deal with a deep sea blowout. And here it's obviously not deep sea, it's shallow. Even so, they need to demonstrate that they have containment resources that are available.
As you know, environmental groups say the U.S. isn't ready to handle a big oil spill in the Arctic Ocean because the conditions there are so harsh and infrastructure is so far away. What's your response to these concerns?
I think there are some fair and legitimate questions that environmental groups have asked. We're going to need to answer those questions to our satisfaction before we give the green light to go forward. We all know that drilling, whether in the Arctic or in the Gulf of Mexico, is not a risk-free activity. But what we have insisted on in the Gulf and what we will insist on here is that we reduce the risks to the maximum extent possible. And that means that we need to be convinced that there is a plan to deal with the unforeseen, that it's got to be well thought out, and that it's got to be capable of being executed. And those are aspects of the Shell contingency or spill response plan that are under examination and that will remain under examination.
The Interior Department has acknowledged that there are big gaps in our scientific knowledge of the Arctic Ocean. Why do you think drilling should go forward despite those gaps? Does BOEMER have a role in closing them?
Those are gaps that we have been working with for now almost three decades. The gaps that have been identified most recently, they dovetail very nicely with our process. I didn't find anything that was really new to us. In fact, I think it validated the process we've been using for 30 years to identify those gaps, and we do our best to fill them. And it is the nature of science. If you answer a question, you're going to get two more. And when you look at the analysis that have been done over the years, the NEPA analysis, environmental assessments, the environmental impact statements, they're getting more and more detailed as the information becomes available.
Government reports were critical of the old Minerals Management Service in Alaska and across the country, saying the agency was too close to the industry. At the Alaska level, how have things changed under the new agency?
Well, they've changed pretty dramatically, and Dr. Kendall is an important symbol and emblem of that change. Dr. Kendall has a background in environmental science. He was the head of the agency's environmental studies program for an extended period of time. And we heard those criticisms of the office, and one of the ways we sought to deal with those criticisms was to put somebody in charge of the office who had a very strong background in science and in environmental science.
And can you give me some specifics on how environmental reviews are done differently now?
Specifically for the Alaska region, the reviews that we're doing now, whether they're environmental assessments, EISs, environmental impact statements, we are making sure that we make the most use of that information we've collected. We will leave no stone unturned. We're making sure the information is the most current. We go out and aggressively get the information from other agencies where they have the expertise. We're willing to step back and say, is there a better way to do this? If we've gone down the trail of doing an EIS or a supplemental EIS or an EA, and we think of something along the way that could make it a stronger document, we will stop the process. And we have stopped the process and said, wait, let's stop for a second. We have something new we can do. We've got new information, something that's occurred. We learned things from the Deepwater Horizon incident that can make our analysis even stronger. And so we can make sure that those analyses are very robust, not only for the court, but for people's comfort level, that we've taken account of all the information, that we're flexible enough that we can take new information and change the course a little bit.
Dr. James Kendall directs the local BOEMER office. Michael Bromwich is the National Bureau Director. Members of the U.S. Senate have formed a bipartisan caucus focused on the oceans, and both of Alaska's senators are on board. Republican Lisa Murkowski is co-chairing it with Rhode Island Democrat Sheldon Whitehouse. The group of 18 senators are all from coastal states. Most are Democrats, but four are Republicans. Senator Murkowski says the group will be a working caucus, sharing information, hosting seminars, and finding common issues to push. Even though oceans cover 70% of the planet, Murkowski says far too little is known about them.
We know less about our oceans than we do about outer space. We know less about our oceans than really is acceptable, because without healthy oceans, We do not have a healthy planet.
The Senate Oceans Caucus says the oceans and coasts support millions of American jobs and added $230 billion in the economy in 2004, more than the entire farm sector. The group had its first meeting today in the U.S. Capitol building. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, remembering an influential Dena'ina Athabascan elder.
He recognized that it was our history, so he wasn't afraid to tackle sensitive topics.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. Attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Ongoing congressional negotiations will determine the fate of many federal programs with a presence in Alaska. Among items proposed for cuts by the President and Congress are 10 Department of Agriculture research centers, including Alaska's. The Subarctic Research Center is headquartered at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, with units in Palmer and Kodiak. UAF Dean of the School of Natural and Agriculture Sciences, Carol Lewis, says a lot is at stake if the agricultural research funding is lost.
In Alaska, ARS fills positions that the state has not filled. For example, the university does not employ an entomologist. They don't employ a weed specialist. They don't employ a plant curator. They don't employ a food scientist. And I could go on.
Lewis says about 20 jobs could be cut if the Alaska ARS's $6 million budget isn't funded. She says it would affect important research, including a potato project in Palmer.
Recently, we just released a new potato variety. It's gotten international attention, and it's gotten the attention of some of the big potato producers in the United States, including Simplot. So that would be at risk, and we'd lose all of the work that we're doing in the villages. We'd lose some of the disease work that we're doing, primarily connected with the entomology, because diseases are transmitted by vectors. And potato is an indicator crop. So you can transfer the work that you do with potato to many other crops.
If the Alaska Agricultural Research Station is cut, Lewis says, the direct hit to UAF would be $1.9 million. The proposed elimination of 10 agricultural research stations is not going unnoticed by U.S. legislators from targeted states. Alaska Senator Mark Begich says they haven't given up on saving the stations as Congress buckles down to sort out the budget. Begich says the focus is on funding programs with extended benefits.
We're worried that if they cut now, we'll lose the benefit years out, because you can't replicate that overnight. So that's the kind of debate we're going to have with some of the people on the budget issues. And I think we can make those debates. Will we be overall successful? That's still hard to say yet.
One possibility being considered to save the Alaska station is a reduced $2 million budget that would fund 4 research positions, including 2 in Fairbanks. The Matanuska Valley has long been the heart of the state's agricultural industry. Growers are riding the crest of the local food trend, which provides something of an economic boost to small farmers. But some say the Eat Local movement is another fad, and a long-term agricultural economy needs better facilities to expand potential markets. An agriculture processing and development center has been a dream of Valley growers since the late 1960s. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports on efforts to make it a reality.
In 1968, a University of Alaska report found Mat Valley peas, compared to their lower 48 counterparts, to be of superior quality while providing greater harvests per acre.
We don't have a pea industry up here because we don't have a way to freeze them, but we have fabulous peas.
Marion Romano, a former Matsu Borough employee who has followed the fortunes of the Planned Ag Center for years, says it will take more than tasty fresh produce to get the facility built.
It's not just somebody's idea of it might, you know, be, this will be great, let's build it. It's, I have a product that I want to sell, and I believe there's a market who wants to buy it. Then you can move forward with an entrepreneur who's ready for that challenge.
The Peace Study found that 1960s Alaska didn't have the population to support a pea production facility, But these days, Valley population is growing, and with it, a demand for local produce.
And just take these big leaves, and you can make a bunch out of them. We'll do it that way.
Right below Pioneer Peak, Paula G. Oakes, 600 acres of vegetables spreads out in razor-straight lines of lettuce, kale, cabbage, and broccoli, all destined for her father's wholesale produce market. Gioke is showing a crew of a dozen or more pickers how to properly cut and bunch kale leaves. Bunches are stacked in waxed cardboard boxes ready for shipping.
It all stays in state. It goes to the local grocery stores and to the wholesalers and military.
The downside, production stops in fall. Carrots, potatoes, and cabbage will store until December, but most of Gioke's business halts with the frost. Could an ag center help her business expand?
Definitely. I would like to expand in those areas, like as far as the broccoli production and the cabbage production. Maybe they could produce like cream of broccoli soup and potato soup and some of those things utilizing what we grow here.
Since the mid-1990s, the borough has acquired grants to pay for a series of studies on the feasibility of an ag center. The borough even gave the state $75,000 for a market analysis related to a central processing facility.
I forgot to turn that off. DeVilbiss.
Larry DeVilbiss sits behind the wide borough mayor's desk. But with his sturdy work shirt and Wolverine Farm cap, he looks like someone who has just come in from milking the cows. Actually, he has just come in from milking his two dairy cows. He raises beef cattle now, but started out as a carrot producer.
As far as I know, we were the first farmers in the state that sustained ourselves just basically growing carrots. And, you know, we could do that with existing infrastructure on the farm, but we came to a point where we realized about 50% of the carrot market was in what's now called the baby peeled carrots that are bagged and everything. That's a level of processing that you cannot do in an ordinary farm root cellar. You've got to have a DEC-approved facility.
DeVilbiss says the Ag Center is on the borough's legislative wish list, but it takes a back seat to big projects like the Kinnickarm Crossing. But the farmer in DeVilbiss understands the need for the processing center. DeVilbiss says in his carrot farmer days, he outgrew his own facilities and had to lease Anchorage storage space to expand his business.
There's a new generation of farmers that we need to grow out of the what I would call the farmer's market phase, where they're just seasonally selling fresh produce, into the phase of managing a business that goes year-round. And I think this facility would help them do that.
He says the borough shouldn't rely on federal funds. Instead, it will take entrepreneurs to get things moving. Last year, the borough assembly put out a request for proposals for design documents and began searching for a contractor with a $250,000 state grant scored in 2006, thanks to then-Senator Lyda Green. That design is complete. There is just no money for construction yet. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
The recent death of a Dena'ina Athabascan elder is being described as a loss of a master of technical traditional knowledge. Andrew Beluda was the first Native park ranger at Lake Clark National Park in 1983. Aaron Leggett is the special exhibits curator at the Anchorage Museum, who is working on an upcoming Dena'ina Athabascan exhibit for the museum. Leggett is also Athabascan and spent time recording Beluda, describing important aspects of Dena'ina life in transition. Leggett says Beluda provided very technical and subtle translations of the language.
He was probably one of the last of this older, you know, Dena'ina generation that really lived his young life off the land, and then certainly in his later life you know, integrated it into the cash economy.
His life was a study in personal tragedy, but also perseverance. Born in 1930 at Miller's Creek, Beluda was one of six children. His father died when he was 7, and his uncle died when he was 10. He was raised by a strong mother and a close-knit extended family. Beluda's book, The People of Non-Dalton, is highly regarded as a definitive work on Alaska Native people. His second book, My Forefathers Are Still Walking With Me, is a collection of verbal essays that Beluda recorded. Leggett says Beluda didn't shy away from sensitive issues such as traditional Dena'ina beliefs before Christianity. Leggett says some elders don't think those past beliefs should be discussed now.
But Andrew was a bit different in that he recognized that it was our history, so he wasn't afraid to tackle sensitive topics.
Leggett says Beluda was working on a book until his death on Dena'ina war stories. Battles took place in the Lake Clark area with other Alaska Native groups.
Some of the older people didn't want him to do that because they thought it would create animosity and that it would bring up hard feelings and all these different things. But Andrew always felt like this is part of our history and we have to talk about it. That you can approach a topic sensitively, you know, without kind of exploiting it, I suppose. But at the same time, you should document it.
Leggett says Beluda now joins a growing list of important traditional elders who are gone but had specific goals in what they wish to convey.
Peter Kalifornsky, Shem Pete Bobby, Albert Wassily, who knew that they didn't want this information to die with them. They wanted their children or any Dena'ina child or anybody really to be able to learn about these things.
Leggett says Beluda's legacy will be one of someone who was able to successfully straddle the divide between the old ways and the modern world. He says when he last saw him, Beluda was able to recall a place name that no one else could remember. Andrew Beluda was 81 at the time of his death. He died on September 1st. Friday at the University of Alaska Anchorage, the nonprofit ANCSA at 40 Committee continued its series on the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971 with a panel entitled ANCSA Corporations Overcome Challenges and Enter the Global Market. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes has the story.
Panelists included leaders of two Native corporations created under ANCSA and Alaska's U.S. Representative Don Young. Young says he and Native leaders pushed to get the act adopted, but the law Congress passed, he says, was not intended to succeed.
This was an experiment, and Alaska Natives actually fooled the people. They made it work.
Young says it's taken decades to fix ANCSA. The newly formed corporations incurred operational expenses immediately, but title to their lands was long in coming. 20 years after ANCSA, the federal government had transferred title to less than half the lands promised to the corporations. Without land to develop, the corporations struggled. Young says a 1984 amendment that allowed them to sell net operating losses to corporations that needed tax deductions helped keep them afloat. He says he has worked on 40 amendments that were critically needed.
The original act allowed, after 91, the lands to be sold, otherwise breaking down the Native corporate, the village corporations, taking the land away from the people by purchases. So we passed the 91 act. That was a very difficult act, but it kept the land as one body, 44 million acres of land, which is the key to this whole program, is the land. So we're able to do that. I think that's the most important one.
Sherry Beretta is board chair for Chugach, the Prince William Sound Regional Corporation, whose operations were devastated by the Exxon Valdez oil spill of 1989. Chugach filed for bankruptcy in 1991. She says even though government services contracts generate low profit margins, they helped Chugach turn around. Beretta says a Missouri senator who is critical of special provisions for Native corporations doesn't realize that government contracts allow managers to learn skills they can put to use in the private sector.
The thing that I hope people recognize is some of these village corporations that are just starting to invest in government contracting may not even be getting the benefits yet because it takes time to build your capacity.
Beretta says Alaskans recognize that the corporations contribute to Alaska's economy by bringing their profits home, distributing dividends to Alaska Native shareholders, and developing Alaskan resources. Former Arctic Slope Regional Corporation Vice President for Governmental Affairs Oliver Levitt says since he retired a few years ago, his thinking has shifted away from the drive to make money and toward protection of tribal status.
When you think about what's happened to our native tribes, why did we leave them behind? It was to be able to say that, yeah, we're doing a lot of things. But when I think about them, that, I think that'd be the, for the native world, I think that'll be the biggest challenge is how do we bring them back in?
Levitt says in the early years after ANCSA was passed, board members were more likely to be carpenters or electricians than financial planners or attorneys. He says today's youth have benefited from corporate scholarships and training and are better prepared than his generation was to handle future challenges, including issues such as protection of tribal rights. In Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Long-distance hiker Andrew Skirka is back in Alaska sharing his adventures and knowledge. Skirka skied, hiked, and paddled a 4,700-mile loop around Alaska and the Yukon Territory in 6 months last year. The National Geographic Adventurer of the Year is now traveling the country talking about his unprecedented trek. Skirka says the Alaska-Yukon trip was different from his previous mega hikes in the lower 48.
This idea of big wilderness, that there is a place that I found, namely up in the northern Alaska, northern Yukon, that was so big, so untamed, so wild, that it didn't matter if it wasn't called wilderness or if it wasn't a wilderness area. It was this place where I didn't belong. I was never comfortable, where I was looking over my shoulder just like every other animal out there. And that was the biggest take-home experience for me, is that just that experience of being in a place like that.
Skirka has a book coming out on lightweight backpacking and guides backcountry trips, including in Alaska. He says he hasn't settled on what his next long adventure will be. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Dan Brass in Fairbanks, Ellen Lockyer in Palmer, and Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
And by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.